Thank you very much, and good morning. And I can only say a few things and with less depth and detail that I would like to in the 20 minutes that I have, so I'm going to jump right into this. And I'm going to start by stating that I am in favor of democracy, and I am opposed to the U.S. policy of promoting democracy. And is there a contradiction here? And I'm going to suggest that there is not a contradiction, that these two positions are entirely consistent, and that, in fact, to be in favor of democracy means to be opposed to U.S. Foreign policy in the name of democracy. Now, let me state clearly that the issue here is not whether democracy is good or bad. It's good. Nor is it whether countries in which the U.S. intervenes under the banner of democracy promotion are democratic or not. The issue is exactly what is the United States doing and why under the banner of promoting democracy. And so what I'm going to do is present 5 points for discussion in this regard. And the first is, what accounts for democracy promotion in U.N.'s foreign policy? And here, historically, the United States and other core powers have promoted, we know, dictatorships and authoritarian regimes in much of the 20th century, and before that, outright colonialism, including occupations and annexations. Historically, therefore, U.S. Policy has been outright suppression, often brutal, of democracy in the Third World. The Somozas, the Trujillos, the Pinochets, the Pop and Baby Docs, the Greek generals, the white minority regimes in southern Africa, the Mobutus, the Suhartos, the Marcoses, the Chiang Kai-sheks, the Mubaraks and Sadats, the House of Saud, and so on. All of these are potent symbols of the long history of U.S. and core power promotion and defense of dictatorial and anti-democratic arrangements throughout the Third World. And I would say theoretically that these arrangements represented direct coercive domination in the international system, direct coercive domination over the Third World by great powers. Then we have in the 1980s this shift from supporting dictatorship and authoritarian regimes to an apparent support for democracy. Why this shift? What happened here? Well, in the 1960s and the 1970s, we had mass movements for democratization. Revolutionary movements, popular democracy movements, spreading everywhere against these dictatorial and these authoritarian arrangements, against local elite orders and against the global status quo. And this instilled fear among U.S. policymakers that these mass democratization movements would not just do away with the particular dictators, but overthrow the elite orders themselves, that they would push for an authentic and more far-reaching democratization process in their countries and in their regions. And the prospects of the whole elite order crumbling, and with it the larger global status quo, provoked fear and trepidation among U.S. policymakers and their strategic thinkers and organic intellectuals. And here, U.S. and global elites were very clear that democracy and democratization movements were profound threats to dominant groups in the emerging global capitalist order. Let's recall the 1970s Trilateral Commission report, The Crisis of Democracy, which was crystal clear in affirming that there is too much democracy around the world, that people had come to believe that they could actually take democracy seriously, that they could demand democratization of society, take their own vital affairs into their hands. Democracy was seen in this report as a profound threat to the elite status quo and to this emerging system of global capitalism. And at the same time, the United States faced a second big challenge, which was how to re-legitimize U.S. foreign policy after Watergate, after the Church Commission hearings, after the rise of a global human rights movement, how to revamp foreign policy after the defeat in Indochina, how to reverse the breakdown of ideological hegemony. And so here, the 1979 overthrow of Somoza in Nicaragua was one of several key turning points for this shift in policy, because it showed U.S. strategists that the old forms of domination, the old-style dictatorships and authoritarian regimes and so on, were no longer viable arrangements for stable domination and defense of local elite orders and a rapidly changing global order. And the conclusions they reached is that it would be necessary to intervene before elite orders themselves are overthrown by mass democratization movements, before more profound social change could take place. And so the challenge here for U.S. strategists was how to manage political change, how to preserve the elite social orders, how to contain struggles of poor majorities for fundamental change beyond a mere removal of dictatorships and procedurally correct elections, how to limit and control that change in such a way that the social order is preserved, how to create a more reliable political system and sets of political institutions for stability and for neoliberal restructuring, which would now begin, because remember, now we're at the dawn of the era of globalization. So in a nutshell, the answer U.S. policymakers gave to this question was to develop new strategies, modalities, and instruments of political intervention under the banner of promoting democracy. And here the emphasis then shifted in U.S. foreign policy beyond state-to-state relations to penetrating civil society itself in intervened countries and assuring social control and limiting change from within civil society itself. And here, U.S. policymakers and their organic intellectuals became, we could say, good Gramscians. They acknowledged that the site of real power is civil society itself. And so U.S. intervention would now bolster allied forces in civil society itself alongside the more traditional state-to-state relations. And theoretically, this U.S. shift then from promoting dictatorship to what it calls democracy in the 1980s and on represents a shift, again, in the Gramscian sense, from a transnational coercive domination to transnational consensual domination, or at least consensus-seeking forms of domination. Now, I can't go into this theoretical part of the argument here. It's fully laid out in the promoting polyarchy, but I do want to highlight the key events in this shift in policy. We have, again, the 1976 Trilateral Commission's famous Crisis of Democracy report, and then we have in 1979 the Nicaraguan Revolution and the key lesson that gave to policymakers. Then we have in 1981 the launching by the National Security Council of Project Democracy to get this shift in foreign policy underway. We have in 1983 the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy and its core groups. Then in 1985, another key turning point in the Philippines, there's a mass insurrection against the Marcos dictatorship that had been supported by the United States. And the Reagan White House for a few weeks is in complete disarray. Should it back some Marcos as it had been doing or support some alternative? And finally, the democracy promotion strategy won out, shifting support from Marcos to the elite opposition under the leadership of Cory Aquino. That was another key lesson. And then we have 1990, the defeat of the Sandinistas through this new strategy. And so that begins the consolidation of this strategic shift in U.S. foreign policy. From 1990 to 2006, we have the further consolidation, the transnationalization, and the expansion of this new strategy, including the creation of the State Department's Office of Transitions Initiatives and other instances. And as we already heard, a spending of up to $2 billion now for this year. So the second of the 5 points is, what is the U.S. actually promoting with this shift? And here we need to look at democracy as what we can call an essentially contested concept. Essentially contested concepts like democracy or like freedom are meaningless in and of themselves. There are competing and even antagonistic definitions of these concepts. And essentially contested concepts, we know, are always ideologically charged. Whoever controls the definition controls the terms of the discourse and is able to set the framework in which people speak of the concept and of the reality to which the concept speaks of. So essentially contested concepts like democracy are never mere words. They're part of real power relations and struggles. So in my view, when U.S. policymakers and transnational elites talk about democracy promotion, what they really mean is the promotion of polyarchy. And this refers, in my approach, to a system in which a small group actually rules and mass participation in decision-making is confined to choosing leaders in elections that are carefully managed by competing elites. In the age of globalization, polyarchy is clearly a more propitious system for managing intra-elite conflict and competition and providing the necessary political environment for globalized economic transactions for which the old regimes were ill-suited. Now, this concept of polyarchy is an outgrowth of elitism theories that developed in the early 20th century to counter the classic definition of democracy as power or rule, kratos, of the people, demos. And it builds on earlier elitism theories that argued for an enlightened elite to rule on behalf of ignorant and unpredictable masses. U.S. policymakers and their organic intellectuals and academia in redefining democracy away from the power of the people and towards polyarchy often cite Joseph Schumpeter in his classic 1942 study, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And they also simplify Schumpeter, it's quite complex. But Schumpeter argued for another theory of democracy as an institutional arrangement for